Welcome to Total Wine & More. It's much more than a wine store. It's the eighth wonder of the world.
When people talk about Total Wine & More, they get a little carried away. We're just a big, friendly place run by people with a passion for wine and beer. See, we travel the world to find the best wines from the best regions, and we sell them at the lowest prices anywhere.
And friendly, helpful experts at every turn.
You know what? Maybe we are the eighth wonder of the world.
Shop in-store or online at TotalWine.com.
Blog Talk Radio.
Contra Radio Network presents Ladies of the Watch.
Good evening, and this is Julie, and we're back with Ladies of the Watch. I've got as my co-host Don, who is Don of the voicelessness, and then we have a guest speaker on right now. Well, guest call in Mike Ronan from Survival Wolves again, and his lovely wife. They're joining us tonight. Listen. I've been on a sabbatical for a while because I had issues with my house. The roof caved in, and I had to take care of some things. But we're making headway, and here we are. And the roof caving in kind of gave me the idea for tonight because I had a whole storage room full of food and preps, and I lost some of it, and I had to give a lot of it away because it was raining. I was going to lose it all if I left it there, and I couldn't put it in a storage shed. And so I thought, well, if shit really hit the fan and all your food was destroyed and it's winter, like it still is up here, even in the middle of April or the beginning of April, how would you find food with snow? Because we still had a couple feet of snow last week. And so I thought I'd talk about winter foraging. I'm a forager from way back. But in the snow, in the Northwest, Pacific Northwest, you know, it's a lot harder to find food than, say, in Florida. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and get started. If we have... on our Ladies of the Watch page on Facebook, I posted some images so you would understand what I'm talking about during the show. So if you write down notes, and then you can go to the Facebook page on Ladies of the Watch, it'll have a contrasting information so you can kind of research and see what I'm talking about. So welcome, Mike. And Don. Don is going to give us a snake rip later, I guess.
I already did.
You already did? Oh, it's on the chat room.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, we're going to start out tonight. It's snowing. It's cold. It's winter. Things are dead. Trees, you know, up here we have conifers, we have pine trees, we have fir trees. We don't have a lot of leafy trees. In the winter, everything is dead. Everything is covered in snow, usually 2 to 3 feet of snow. And if you had to survive up here in the winter, it would be pretty tough. There's still lots of food, and if you know what you're looking for, it's not too bad. But you're going to have to do some work. They're talking about eating rats now in the chat room already. It's already started. But the first one I was going to talk about is making fish traps, because if you're anywhere, I don't care where you are in the winter, if there's a running stream, you might have a lake that's been frozen over, there's food in there. You just have to figure out how to get to it. And that, so I thought I'd start with fish traps, because people and fishing, that's not a something out of your realm of knowledge, usually. So on Ladies of the Watch, what I did was I put pictures of possible fish traps, or two simple ones. Remember, our show is geared for women who may not know a lot about prepping right now, and they want to learn. So you guys who already know this, this may be boring for you. But the first picture I've got is a two-liter bottle, and we made a minnow trap out of it. You cut off the top of the neck of the two-liter bottle. It could be a pop bottle, it could be Mountain Dew, whatever. And you take the nose cone and you flip it around inside the bottle, poke some holes in it, and tie it shut. So it's basically a funnel that goes into a bottle. And you can tie a little string on it and stick it in the water. You can put whatever you want in there for food, bread, meat. They like bacon, whatever. And you throw it out in the river, and you'll catch a whole bunch of minnows that way. The premise of this fish trap with the plastic bottle is the fish go in through the nose, but the space along the side, it's hard for them to find the hole to go back out because it's so small. And the angle of a fish to go through that hole, if they get bumped on the sides, they won't like to try it. So it's kind of a self-defeating deal. And they'll just go up the length of the neck on the sides, and you'll have a bunch of minnows. So if you're doing minnows, you can eat minnows. You can put them in a soup. You can do whatever you want with them, or you can use them as bait to catch larger fish or other things. The second and third picture is a fish trap that we use. It's exactly the same premise as the bottle, but we made it out of twigs. You can make it out of willow, which tend to be a little softer and greener, and they're easier to work with. But you can pretty much do it with anything you find. And it's exactly the same premise. Make a triangle out of twigs, wrap the bottom, and then you make another circle with another one exactly like it, but in smaller, and then you insert it so it looks just like the plastic bottle. On the second picture where they're wrapped in, it's the same premise. Bigger fish go in, but they can't get out. Now, in the picture, they have the horizontal pieces, but they don't have the vertical pieces. I like to do vertical pieces as well because it gives it some extra strength, and it keeps the bigger fish from trying to force its way out through the holes, because it's when you're making these traps, it's really hard to get them evenly spaced to where they're all small enough that the small stuff won't sneak through it. And if you're in a starvation situation or I'm in trouble, you don't want to lose a lot of stuff through the holes. Don says it may be a good idea to have small holes in it to allow for water flow so they still get excellent oxygen. Update by her Cub Scout nephew. And that's true. You're going to poke a few holes in the bottom anyway to let the water out. So when you pick it up, I guess. I don't know. You can do that. It depends on how long you're letting it sit there. Our rule of thumb is on traps, you're going to go check them every couple hours because you don't want something to suffer or die or get stolen by something else that might be hungrier than you. And then the third picture that I have on the Ladies of the Watch page is the completed fish trap. And it was another way that I had not looked at it. They took the trap and they built an underwater fence to kind of funnel fish into your trap. And there's lots of ways to do it. These aren't by any long stretch the only ways to do this, but they're good starts for you to look at and use your imagination. Let me think. I don't know how clear it is when you're trying to describe pictures. But the second way of catching fish or looking at things like that, these fish traps can be used for fish. They can be used for minnows. They can also be used for crawdads or other things that crawl and swim, depending on where you are in the country. I mean, up here, we're pretty limited. We have trout. We don't have a lot of catfish. We have some carp. We have some garbage fish. We have crawdads. They might call them crawfish down south. And then we have salmon, things like that. So depending on what you're catching is going to be the size of what you're making, obviously. The other thing that we can do is trot lines, and we use them up here. You take a line, and it's basically a line with a lot of stretched hook spets all along with bait. And you have an anchor at one end, and you can tie one to the tree, to a tree, and throw your line in so it just sets out there. You want to make sure that your bait's off the bottom a little bit. If it's on the bottom, you're going to catch something like a catfish or a bottom feeder. If it's off the ground a little bit, then you'll catch something, perch or whatever you guys have. Don says you can also attract bears, raccoons, otters, possums, et cetera, to your fishing hole if you leave them overnight. And she said, on the other hand, you might attract bigger fish. A lot of it depends on where you're throwing your line. Our streams up here, we've got a couple of lakes, and if they ice over, you're going to hack holes through it to get to drop your line. Back in Michigan where I grew up, we had ice fishing huts, and you just go in and chop a big old hole, and you can drop your line down there, and you just keep scooping it out so it doesn't freeze over. Up here, I wouldn't do it. Our lakes don't get that thick of ice, so it's kind of dangerous. But you can do this off the shore. You can do this off the riverbanks. Trot lines, you can, like I say, you can throw an anchor in on one side so it's underwater and tie the other end to a tree or whatever and toss 4, 5, 6 hooks in and leave them there all day and you'll catch something. We also take pop bottles and drink out the pop, tighten them up, tie a line on each end, throw them out in the water and let the strings dangle between them and let them float, but keep them attached to a tree and go pick them up later because they float. And then you also can see where your fish are when that happens because they float around and they're easy to see. And there's pictures of both of those in the Ladies of the Watch page. All right. Apparently there's some background noise. I'm sorry if there is. Am I being clear, or is this kind of, does this make sense? It's basically just different ways of fishing. Fishing, in the winter. Oh. Okay. So the other thing that we do here and in this would be perfect in the winter is I make glue sticky traps. Glue sticky traps. You get a piece of paper, you get cardboard or a board. And you can make your own glue. You can go out and buy glue, like Tangle Trap or something like that. There's Tanglefoot, Tack Trap, Catchmaster. They come in small containers. But you can make your own glue, if you're inclined, by mixing a quart of water and a quart of corn syrup. And then you boil it. And it makes, as it reduces, it makes a really sticky glue. But it's kind of a personal preference. What you're looking for is something that's really, 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 really tacky and does not dry. You don't want it to harden because then if it sits there for a while, obviously things will scamper right over the top of it and not get stuck. But we'll take a board, and I'll drill a couple holes on the end, and I'll run cord through each end, and I'll stick them on a branch in a tree. And then I'll put a little bait in the center. I'll put the glue on it, and I'll tie it to a branch, and I'll put some kind of bait on it, and you can catch squirrels. You can catch chipmunks. You can catch birds that come down and set on it, and they can't fly off. They get stuck. Even if they fight hard enough to pull loose, they have a lot of problems with picking up other stuff, and they can't get very far. And so there's a lot of there's some ideas that we do. We tie them up in a tree, and then you just go check them every hour, every 2 hours, and you can catch a lot of little birds, a lot of chipmunks, a lot of squirrels with those. And you just take them off and leave the glue out there and catch another one. My kids did that when they were growing up. But our squirrels and our chipmunks, I don't know if you guys have chipmunks down there on the south, but up here they're pretty small, so they're a little bit, they're bigger than mice. But they make really good, if you get enough of them, you can make quite a good meal out of them. Let me think here. Over here, we've got, on Ladies of the Watch, I have a winter foraging number 3. It's an Apache fish trap. These are the ones I really like. And if you're stuck in the woods or if you're out by yourself, they're real handy. You don't need anything but sticks. And it's basically an M-shaped trap, same idea as the funnel. You're trying to funnel everything in. But this one with the opening, the reason it's self-explanatory. It's a video that I've posted on there. But the fish don't like to go out because they can't center themselves enough so they don't hit the sides. And they tend to stay in the cage part. And that one you can set there and they can set all day and they're always live. That's part of the deal that I like is that you're not killing anything like with leg traps or deadfalls and things like that. Your food is alive until you come and get it, which keeps it fresh, keeps it humane, and keeps it from if it's not what you want, you can turn it loose. Let me think. Is there any questions so far there, Mike, or your wife? Nope. Okay. Winter foraging food. We have a lot of issues here with the winter because we get so much snow. But things that are still snow here are pretty edible. We have a lot of things you can eat in the summer. Burdock, we're talking about, things like that. Burdock is a weed up here, and they try to get you to kill it every year because it's an invasive species. But it's a thistle, and the root is really, really good. There's very many types of them, but even in the winter, they have a really big basic root system, and I'm trying to figure out where this is. Hang on. And you can dig them up as long as the ground isn't totally frozen. You can eat the leaves, you can eat the flowers in the summer, but they get really spiky, and so we cook them just like. You can eat them in the salads and things, but we cook ours down. Nettles are another one. They tend to last longer up here. In the winter, in the summer, you can get them. Whoops, hang on a second. How would you be safe with Are you talking about the Hanta virus and other such diseases with rodents such as chipmunks, squirrels, and mice? And she says, yep. Hanta, mice carry it. I'm not sure chipmunks and squirrels carry Hanta. I've never heard of anybody getting it through rodents and chipmunks. I know they have it in mice, and there's been some areas around here that had carried it. But Hanta is carried through the poop, basically, of mice and the dander, and it's in the dust. They said, yeah. Oh, she said chipmunks do, but squirrels are unknown.
Hello.
I did not know chipmunks. But it's usually in their feces. Excuse me?
Well, I've been eating your watermelon because it's soft on the throat.
Oh,
so.
There's rabies and other such diseases. And yeah, you're gonna have to. You're gonna have to see when you catch an animal if it's going crazy. You know, if it's acting like a normal animal, if it looks sick.
Sure.
I mean, we're talking about winter foraging when you have no other recourses.
Okay.
So.
Okay, baby. I love you.
There's.
Bye.
Hey, Don. I can hear you. I mean, before you eat anything, you need to examine it anyway and make sure it's not moldy, it doesn't look ill or unhealthy, it's not diseased, even plants, things like that. I went back to that. If you're hungry, you're going to probably eat things that you wouldn't necessarily eat on a normal
There's
basis.
There's no probably about that. There is no probably about that. If you're hungry, you're going to eat what you're going to eat. I have seen
people
who are foodies
but you're not
who
want...
not touch something, eat raw meat off of a bone. So, yeah, you're going to eat what you're going to eat.
Yeah. I used to watch, there was this video of this guy. He used to eat roadkill, and he'd pick up worms and stick them in a can, and he'd get something, and he'd say, okay, if it's this stiff, it was killed like 4 hours ago. If it's this stiff, you don't want to eat it. If it's loose again, even though you know it's been dead for a while, it's already past the rigor mortis stage and it's 2 days old. And I'm not into that, but
you're not starving either.
Yeah, very true. Because I would go eat crawdads or fish out of the river before I would eat something dead on the side of a road, unless it was a deer and I watched it get hit.
One of the things I was surprised you didn't bring up when it comes to animals is I was surprised you didn't bring up earthworms, which if you grind them up and you cook them, they taste, I've been told by a lot of
like
people,
coffee.
They taste not only like coffee, but depending on what dirt you have them in, if you have like really good fertilized dirt before you eat them, they taste like chicken, they taste like beef, they taste like whatever you put into that soil for them to eat. And it's a real high protein, low impact meal because you're not having to hunt it.
Yeah. And I could see that. We used to have a kid that ate worms in junior high and we all pointed at him and made fun of him for a reason, I'm sure. But if you're hungry, yep. I watched what was it? Survivor, a level of Survivor. And they were all skinny and they were all starving to death and they were catching grasshoppers and they were using them as fishing bait and they kept losing them and they kept catching fish or turtles or whatever and they'd turn the turtles loose and they'd lose the grasshoppers. And I'm thinking, why didn't you just eat the grasshoppers? So, you know, one for me and one for the fish and one for me and one for the turtle. But as humans, I don't think, well, non-preppers, they don't get into the mindset to eat that sort of thing. Rad says watermelon. Yes, but this is winter foraging, dear. Like I was saying, you have burdock, you got nettles, cattails. Nettles, let's go back to nettles. Nettles stay... They freeze on the plants. They hang out all winter. They're wilted and such, but they taste like spinach. They're real high in vitamin C. In the winter, I've never tried them in the winter, so I don't know if they still sting or not. But if you take a bunch of nettles and you boil them and you pour off the water and then you boil them again, you lose all that little toxin stuff that they carry in their hairs. And they're really actually very good, and they're very nutritious. Oh, we've got guest 681 in the chat room. Welcome. The other thing that we have up here are cattails. Cattails are freaking everywhere. Now, in the winter, they're all dried up, you know, but the roots and the rhizomes on the bottom are still green underwater or under the ice. So if you can get into the base of the cattails, they're still really good, and they're very they were a big staple for the Native Americans out here, not to mention that the heads can be used as different things, and the leaves you can make baskets. There's all sorts of stuff. Even if they're dried out, they're really useful. And the older they are, you can make your fish traps out of them. So cattails are pretty good. Rose hips stick around all winter long. They freeze. You make jelly out of them when they're frozen. You can eat them. They make tea. They're super high in vitamin C, like with Don being sick. You can...
Yeah. Listen to you, Miss Consumption.
Rose hips are a really good one, and they're everywhere up here. Pine tea. There's pictures of pine needles versus fir needles on the... Contrary, everything tastes good with butter, that's for sure. The stuff that I'm talking about up here is Pacific Northwest specific, at least Montana, I think, Wyoming, you know, this half of the area has these things. Pine needles, they make a good tea. You can eat them. Most of the coniferous plants up here, you can make a tea out of, except yew. Yew is really poisonous, and you don't want to go near it. And then as the winter goes to spring, yes, Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and Montana, says Dawn. We eat violets. Johnny Jump-Ups come up in the spring. Those are good. All that stuff is edible. Dandelions, people usually wait for the heads. But anything that's still in the ground, dandelion roots, you can dig all that stuff up. You just have to be careful with dandelions because too much of it will make you ill. You don't want to eat the root. You can dry it and use it for teas and things, but you have to take it moderately. Dandelions, when you're eating, you want the leaves. So let me think. Another thing we have over here, Dawn's got it on her side, is seafood. Along the ocean, even up here, we have freshwater clams in all our rivers. All you have to do is go kind of run your fingers through the silt in the bottom of the rivers, and you'll find clams everywhere. Down in the ocean, you've got clams, you've got mussels, you've got kelp, the brown kelp. All that stuff is all year long in the winter. And I started thinking about all this stuff and how dependent we get on buying stuff from the stores, and that as preppers, we should be utilizing some of this stuff, even in the winter, going out and trying these things. Rose hip tea is really good for colds and flus. Let's see. Dawn says, no hemlock either. If you've never been trained, don't try to treat... anything that hemlock is used for, period. No oleander, anything. People recommending it for gout.
I found a blog. Yeah. Have you seen that blog yet, Julie?
Uh-uh.
There's a blog out here in the Pacific Northwest that's talking about toxic chemicals, toxic herbs, and how to use them in treatment. And there's a woman who actually, I kid you not, I challenged her on this, is saying oleander tea for gout.
Oleander tea, that's from, what's the common name on that? I know the flower, it's like a magnolia, isn't it? They're extremely toxic.
The oil itself, if you leave it on your hands, will soak through your skin. And people are recommending it now.
I haven't done that. But with plants, everything has a good side and a bad side. Everything has a beneficial side and a negative side. And it's all in proportion. And you need to be able to research these things and make sure what you're using is what you think it is, because there are so many things that are very similar to others. And that's why I chose real basic things tonight that are really common up here that everybody knows by sight fairly commonly, because there's so much you can get in trouble with. But I know the food, you know, I know the food up here. I know the stuff up here. But even then, you want to find, what you should do is go find a book that talks about foraging in your area. I have two or three that have foraging and plants, edible and medicinal plants of the Pacific Northwest. And when you look at it, you want to get one that has really, really good detailed pictures. I don't like the ones with drawings because people made them and they could be a mistake. Let's see. Oh, Don put a link on a link to edible plants of the U.S. But somebody sent me a link today about edible plants in Florida, and there's some for edible plants of the Midwest. If you go on Amazon and look around, you can find plants for your area. And I look for the ones that are well-written, obviously, but they have really, really good photos in them, and I can cross-check them and cross-reference them against other photos to make sure, because some of them are hard. The other thing I would do is I personally stay away from mushrooms. There's a lot of mushrooms. Everybody up here says, oh, these are all edible. But I don't know them well enough. And when you get into mushrooms, they're tricky. My friend goes and gets morels, and those are pretty obvious. But even then, they're false morels. And if the stems are not hollow, or if the stems are solid, or if you cut them wrong and they drip a spore pattern that's white or black, and all these different things, that's going to tell you whether they are poisonous or not. And I don't really have the patience to determine that for mushrooms. So that one I stay away from. And if you go talk to your ranger station in your area, they have usually some really good books or pamphlets and advice and things like that that they could you can buy there. They have their founts of knowledge, and they love to share. And every one of them up here has said stay away from the mushrooms. So they said there's so many people that are poisoned every year. So, but there, I lost my train of thought. Thank you. But those are some of the things I was thinking about this winter. And I was thinking about doing a four-part, like winter, spring, spring, summer, summer, fall, and then fall back, winter again, down the road as things come out. But I think what you should do right now, because we're right on the cusp of spring, is go out and look at your area and look at the plants. They're beaten down. They're under the snow. They're dried. They're brittle, at least up here. And see what things look like now, because it changes in the spring, and it changes in the summer, and it changes in the fall. And as preppers, we're always thinking, oh, it's going to, the shit's going to hit the fan, and we're going to be prepared, and it's going to be sunny out, or it's going to be, it's not going to be raining, and I'm going to be young, and I'm going to be athletic, and I'm going to be able to shoot people and handle this and cook outside and do that. But the things that I found out in the last couple months is when your shit hits the fan, you're not always ready for it. It's not going to happen like you think it is, and you have to be able to rise to any occasion. And food is definitely a big one. I lost 3 years' supply of food here, and it just killed me. And it killed me to give it away. But I gave it away to new preppers who were just starting out, and it gave them a base place to start with as well. So, you know, you've got to be prepared. For me, skills are my big thing rather than what I had in place. I don't rely on guns like some of the guys, and I don't rely on all these gear heads, all these things these gear heads do. I was raised in old school, and we learned to live off the land, basically. We learned to rough it. We learned to make fire without all the stuff you guys have now, some of the older ways. And I forgot a lot of that. And I think we do because we start relying on things. When the prepper movement started, everybody got into gear. Fortunes were made by selling dehydrated foods and all the rest of that stuff. And if we really think about it, we need to, as preppers, go out and learn what's out there too, because if you don't have gear or you lose your gear, you're going to have to survive anyway, and you're just going to have to figure it out. And that was the purpose of this. I know I meander on, but it's a really important topic. And winter is a big one, because if your shit hits the fan in the winter, you still have to go on, and you need to be prepared for these things. And that's pretty much what I was thinking there. Don?
No, Conrad brought it up. Conrad wanted to make sure we did our plug for Contra Radio for their shopping.
Oh. John wants us to say, yeah, sorry. John wants us to say that they're selling Contra Radio t-shirts. And they're on the, he's nodding. And if you go to our CRN page, I'll post it on the Ladies of the Watch page, the link. There's t-shirts, sweatshirts, that sort of thing. They're actually pretty sharp. And they help support the radio show. It's not just us on Ladies of the Watch. There's Contra Don, which is the political part. There's John, who has a roundtable on Wednesday. And then there's another discussion on Sundays. I'm a little bit out of the loop, so I'm not sure what he talks about on Sundays. He has a specific topic every week. But go take a look at the network store and see if there's anything that you like there. I'm trying to think. Don, do you have anything else you want to say? You had some snake recipes, which you posted here. Are you going to put them down on the Facebook page? She's ignoring me. So It's hard when Don can't talk. I've relied on her for so long. But Don's posted some snake recipes. There's a cookbook for snakes. Not that we have snakes in the winter up here, but down south you might. Winter foraging would be a lot easier down there, I'm sure, when you have food year-round. But take a look at your area and see what you can find.
Another thing to think about with winter foraging is that you're going to have a challenge when it comes to your weather based on what you can forage and what you can't. Good example, if you can forage with the idea of winter in mind, your wood and your things that you're going to have to keep dry, you don't want to be foraging that in the winter because then it's wet, soggy, not going to work. So when you're foraging year-round, think about the next season and what you may need then.
Right. If you didn't hear what Dawn was saying, she was saying think about foraging a season ahead, too, because things could be wet, they could be soggy, they could be whatever. Up here it gets wet, but there's ways, there's always places where the wood is dry. We get squaw wood, and it's the little teeny twigs under the trees. Oh, we've got a caller.
I got him.
New caller?
Yes.
Oh, hi, John.
Hey, John.
Hello. It's a blessing that Dawn can't talk.
Oh, you know,
well,
wait until my voice gets
blessing
back.
Because I'm boring.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I can hear her squelching back there. It sounds like she's in the death throes, flopping on the back of the background, throwing herself against walls and whatnot. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I hack up a lung, so we're kind of...
It happens a lot, but I don't care about her sex life.
No. Every 5 seconds, I've got a kid or my husband coming in asking if I'm okay, because Mom normally doesn't get sick like this.
Why don't you just get off the air, and I'll help, and I'll assist.
Assist me
oh,
now.
Oh, good God.
Where were you 20 minutes ago when I needed help?
All right, well, I was waiting to see if she would ever, you know, but
gonna pop,
I can't take it anymore. I can't take it anymore, so.
Hey, by the way, it's not me that's coughing. That's Julie.
I'm coughing, and she's got a lot of coughing.
And she has the consumption. She sounds like Doc Holliday in the bar.
Yeah.
I'll be your Huckleberry.
No, I'm sure you will, but it won't be today.
So John's crew is here, yes, in all our glory. But,
all right, so
well,
I'm going to go ahead
well, don't
and
forget,
fail.
You could, there are plenty of weeds you can eat also that are all over the United States. And
absolutely.
You know, Dawn brought up a good point many months ago, and that was, you know, some of you aren't going to like the idea, but for your own edification, it was, I believe Dawn said, look, find a Wiccans that are in your area, because they know all about edible plants in their area.
Find your pagans. Find your pagans that do natural healing. Find your kitchen witches. They're the ones that will be able to tell you what's good and what's bad. When Julie was talking about the mushrooms, the first thing that hit me, I'm going to be hitting the acid trippers. And the reason being is those guys watch their mushrooms like a hawk. They'll tell you which ones happen to be their money guys, which ones are poisonous, and which ones are edible. Because they've either been through it, harvested it, or sold it. So that part of society that you guys don't want to admit exists, you want to be hitting them up when it comes to foraging, because they're going to be so far ahead of the game, it's not even funny.
Well, and I have a friend that, like I say, that hunts morels and stuff, and they know their mushrooms. And I've had a few mushroom books just in case I wanted to do it, but it is so confusing. There are so many types, and it really is something that I don't think I would trust myself to do.
Well, you can do, Julie, and this is what I recommend for people in your and in my, I'm the same way that you. What I would do is I could hold somebody who knows, get a batch of edible mushrooms growing for yourself now. If you have the edible batch growing for yourself now, you don't have to forage.
Right. Well, you can also take they have them where you can grow them and you just seed them and they come back every year. Part of the foraging plan when you're going out and foraging, you don't want to strip the area of everything that's edible. You want to always leave some to regrow and repopulate that area. You know, if you
well,
go
that's
in
a good point.
If you go in and strip everything out, it's never going to grow back. So same thing with mushrooms. I mean, there's sites online all over the place where you can get, you know, I guess they're spores, mushroom spores, and you can seed them in your backyard and grow your own mushrooms. And they say, well, you'll get two growings out of them or 1 year of them or whatever. But if you cut part of them and leave part of them, they'll just reseed themselves over and over again. And then you won't ever have to worry about it.
One of the things with Julie's situation right now that we should be thinking about, she just realized everything she's prepped for is gone.
Yep.
We should be taking that as a learning lesson and start prepping now for that potential. Because if you think that once the shit hits the fan, it's time to start foraging and prepping, you're too late when it comes to your seedings. You need at least 2 years on good seedings in order to get bounteous harvest. So you need to be planting now to plan for 2 to 3 years out if you're planning on foraging in your own arena. Go out in the wild areas that you know you're going to be hitting. Plant those things that are edible in your area. Nothing that happens to be, can't think of the word right now. It has to be indigenous. Nothing that's invasive. But plant it deliberately in your area. Let it seed for 2 or 3 years, because then what's going to happen? Number one, you're bettering your wildlife. Number two, now you have yourself something you can go to and have a story.
That's a very good point. We call it wild seeding here. I plant a garden every year, but the deer usually get it. But we also take it up the hill, and I'll plant extra stuff out in the woods, just so it blends into the woods. I mean, a long time ago they were talking about that. They plant so where you know the food is, you can plant stuff that grows, reseeds itself every year. So you got to have the non-GMO, the heirloom stuff. But if you take it out and you just plant it around your area, things that you know are going to reseed themselves, then you will always have a food source outside of your place. If, like, we live on a floodplain, a 100-year floodplain, and it floods about every maybe 10 years from the snow load up on the hill. It doesn't come from our river. It comes up from the mountains. But it washes out our garden. It washes out everything. But everything that we've planted on the hill comes back every year. And so it's a buffer against the future, you know. And you always need to kind of prepare for the unexpected. And that's what Don was talking about.
Do you have any calls pending?
I don't. They're all...
No, hey, Mike, call back in. Drop off and call back in. I just checked. I'm muted, unmuted, and everything. Nothing's on our side. Maybe you just lost the connection. So call back in, too.
I got a question for you, Julie.
Okay.
You know, when you're cooking your rodents, how do you ensure that they aren't diseased? I mean, granted, you could look at it. You're not going to see any microbes or anything on there.
No.
So how do you, you know, I hate to say the for lack of a better term, how do you make it safe to eat?
Well, I'm going to say some of it is going to be a crapshoot because you're eating something that's been running around in the woods or, you know, the dirt or whatever. But I would look at it and say, okay, is it fat and healthy looking? Is it patchy? Is it look sick? Is it skinny? You know, is it foaming at the mouth? Is it, I mean, obviously it would be struggling to get away if you hadn't killed it right away and things like that. But example, wild rabbits. When you clean a wild rabbit, you look at its internal organs. You look at its lungs. You look at its liver. You look at its heart. Do they look normal? Are they a good color? Do they have spots on them? All those things. Is it fat and healthy? Is it glossy? In the winter, it's a little bit different because even up here, We look at the deer and the mountain goats and the sheep that we have. They look really, their hair looks coarse and brittle and dry. They're usually fairly skinny because it's been a harsh winter. And our mountain sheep have pneumonia, and it's killing off big herds of them, except the herd that's in my canyon are the only ones that keep surviving. They're the healthiest. But...
Hey, Mike's calling in.
Yeah, I got him.
Hey,
one
you got
thing
him?
That you can do...
Got me now?
Yeah,
you hear me?
A lot of people don't think about this, is one of the things you can do is, unless you're starving and you have to cook that sucker right now, what they do in the poverty areas, like in Laos and New Guinea and places where they have to eat garbage diggers, possum is a good one, is they take it and they hold it for like 2-3 weeks and they feed it nothing but the food that they want to eat, rice, vegetables, this type of thing. So what happens,
they're cleaning it out.
Yeah, during the purge, what you can also do at that point is give it a deworm. You know, pop in a deworm and it's not going to kill you. You're talking a month cycle. If it's got some parasite, it's going to kill. Now, I don't recommend doing this unless you have to do research. What happens is if you go to kill
the other thing I would do is soak it in salt water for a while.
Yes.
Salt kills just about everything. But, I mean, being vigilant and looking at it and saying that it looks healthy, its internal organs are healthy. I mean, if you're sick, your insides are going to show it for the most part.
You mean like Dawn, if we cut her open?
Yeah,
Dave,
well,
you wouldn't
want
to see my insides. My liver's probably already dead.
Yeah, we all sound...
Hey, I think Mike had a question.
Okay, Mike.
Hold on. Hey, what about people like me that can't eat seafood or fish? What then?
Iodine, right?
So you have an iodine issue?
I can't eat any kind of seafood.
So that would leave out kelp and all that, because that's all high in iodine, too.
There's a land-based version of everything. Can't eat kelp, then go ahead and eat the black grass.
Well, a lot of trees have bark and things like that you can still eat. lichen up here in the Pacific Northwest. Lichen's very edible. It's not extremely delicious. But it's nutritious and it'll keep you alive. I personally like the sticky traps that I was talking about, because you can make 5 or 6 sticky traps, and up here squirrels and chipmunks are everywhere. And so
it actually does taste like chicken.
That way they're easy to catch. You know, they're you don't have to worry about like making snares and funneling them into your snares and things like that. You set them on trees and pathways that you know they're going to go. You bait them because they're hungry too, and they can't get away. You can do a ton of them and go check, and you're bound to catch 2 or 3 almost any time. Hibernating winter animals are kind of tough, you know?
Meat in the winter gets a little tougher because you don't have that fat layer that's been building up in spring and summer. So,
right.
Yeah, that was actually pretty much a loaded question, Julie. Answered it really good, because, you know, I know I'm not the only one out here that has that allergy that can't eat seafood or fish or anything like that.
Okay.
No, that's a fairly common one, actually.
There is a growing group of individuals who are, by the way, talking about hibernation. There's a growing group of individuals who are trying to push to go ahead and harvest bears in hibernation. And I'm going to tell you why that's a real bad idea.
Me too.
I'm going to tell you why that's a real bad idea. It's not just because of the humanity side or the emotional side. Bears go through a chemical change that actually puts them to sleep for that long duration. We are still researching what type of dopamine they are releasing in their body so that they can go ahead and go the entire winter without pooping, pissing, their breath is down, they don't wake up. If you are to harvest a hibernating bear, you have no idea what type of hormones you are actually eating and what the side effects could possibly be to your body.
Right. Well, I don't think they're going to be eating them. I mean, if you've ever eaten anything that gets scared, I mean, the videos they're showing is, you know, they can't kill them right away. They're killing them and then they're running and they're doing all this stuff.
It's a brutal video.
It's going to taste horrible. You know, it's not, you don't know what it's going to do to you. But if you've ever shot at a running deer, the meat.
Yeah, I have. It's not
nasty.
Easy as people think.
No.
That's one of the reasons why I've told my kids that before we go shooting for live, that they're going to go ahead and practice on dead, you know, dead targets or, you know, pop-up targets.
Right.
The thing is because after that first shot, if you miss or you nick and you have not taken them down, you're pretty much contaminated the whole meat. It's just like with the salmon. You've got to grab it and you've got to hit it over the head as quickly as possible.
Right.
Exactly. You know, if you don't hit it, kill it. First shot, and you're in for a long day. You got to hunt that puppy down.
He's horrible. Can you eat fish, like fish?
No, I can't.
No,
seafood, fish, shellfish, or anything. I can't. It kill me.
Because there's different impact. I mean, some people can eat fish, but not shellfish. Some people can eat, you know.
Yeah.
I can't
Let's put it this way. With his allergies, Jimmy, if you were to cook a fish in a skillet and then clean it really well and then cook meat in it, it's still possible.
Right. I can't even be around it when it's cooking. That's how bad I am.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, he's brought that up before. I remember that.
I vaguely remember that. But there's going to be.
But my wife, on the other hand, she loves it and enjoys it, which, you know, I don't have a problem with. She can cook it all she wants as long as it's not around me. And she does, and we're cool. So, she didn't believe me, and she found out I wasn't BSing her. About the time she had to take me to the hospital.
I have a question for hunters, okay? And this is an honest, new question because I've never done it. I've heard people do it. It sounds kind of weird, but can you eat apex predators such as cougar and wolf? And if you can, what is it?
Yes, you can. Yes, you can.
Can you eat what?
And it's not as bad as people may think. Dog is part of the wolf family. And
they're not eating the same thing wolves are.
No, I'm just saying that dog is part of the wolf family.
Right, but their diet, from what I understand, makes their meat very musky and off. Is that true?
Not really. Not really. I've had
dog
before, and it's not that bad. You know, it don't taste like chicken, I'll tell you that. But it's not that bad.
My dad ate it in Thailand. But
that actually does kind of taste like chicken if you don't know what you're eating.
Uh-huh.
But if you know what you're eating, then cat, yeah, it's kind of stringy, and it's not really that bad. You know, if you're hungry,
I'd eat it.
I'll eat it.
I'd eat it. But, I don't know. So other plants you can eat up here, we have Oregon grape. They're usually an ornamental plant, and I've eaten the berries, but they're not around, but you can eat the inner bark on the stems and the roots,
And it's also medicinal. It's got the same compound in golden seal, which is an immune system, antibacterial, anti-inflammatory.
No, that's good.
So it works in for dual purposes. You know, you can use it for medicines too. And it's not a big toxic plant. I mean, up here, it took me years to realize that you could eat it because, you know, it was always in the neighbor's yard.
Yeah, you can eat birch too, right?
Right. And you can eat birch, you can eat, a willow, you can eat.
Yeah, willow.
Hang on.
Dandelion.
Julie,
ate
dandelion and wine.
No, Julie was the one that
verified. Dandelions are really good. And like you touched on earlier, Julia, the leaves are what you want to eat. But
right.
The root is actually what makes it for dandelion wine. People don't know that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's awesome.
Well, and it's good for your kidneys. It flushes your kidneys.
Exactly.
And that's where you have careful because it makes a really good cleanser, tonic, but just like everything else, you can't take a lot of it. You know, your body isn't set up to take all that stuff. We have up here,
right.
We got chicory, and they're beautiful plants, but they're a weed. They grow freaking everywhere.
Well, chicory was actually help stand cotton.
Right. And you can eat the root. If you dry it up, you can make it. It's a good coffee substitute.
Right.
You can eat the leaves. You can eat the flowers of it. They're kind of bitter, but the root is where the the value is in it.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say earlier, but I guess you couldn't hear me, so.
I'm sorry.
No, tubers are the way to go during the wintertime because that's where everything is at. It's in the ground.
Right. Right. And
believe me.
I'm thinking,
it's
too,
good.
Because it's... Is it? Have you had chicory?
Yeah, I have.
I've got it all over the place, but I've not tried it yet.
It's bitter as hell, like you said, but it's not that... That actually, when you're hungry.
Oh yeah, well, and that's the deal there. excuse me, hold on. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that we've missed as far as here. I mean, you can eat just about anything.
You know, you touched on willow. You touched on a cat. And you touched on all that. That's good because a lot of people don't realize that cattails you can eat.
Oh,
and cattails
are delicious.
You can make fire from them. A lot of people don't realize that.
Oh yeah, and a cattail is one of those survival prepper things that you can't hardly live without. I mean. We've talked about this on other shows with John doing his, I can't talk about private stuff, but the heads, the cattail heads, the fluff, makes good
right.
stuffing for menstrual pads, for baby's diapers, for pillows, insulate your clothing, your socks, you know, all that stuff.
I didn't think about that. That's good thinking, too.
It's really good for it. If you get enough fluff, it really makes good insulation. It's absorbent. When the heads are small, when they're first coming up in the spring and they're green, they taste like corn on the cob. You eat them when they're young.
Yeah.
You can peel the stems, shed them, and cut them up. They're really good when they're green.
Right.
You just eat the roots, the rhizomes, and all of that. Then you can take them and dry them and use them. You can weave them. We used to weave them into placemats and make, you can make clothing out of them, loincloths. You can make rain hats. You can make all sorts of stuff. Cattails are awesome.
Oh, yeah, and they're nature's multi-tool.
Right. Exactly. So, I mean, there's so much out there that
we can use in the nature. And I think that's more important as preppers, that we learn how to use what's about us. You know, people always go on about skills and skills and skills. But those are the important things. I mean, you can lose everything
right.
and still survive. If
you need
if you
skills,
don't lose your head.
You need knowledge, you need gear. But mostly
right.
skills. And without that, you might as well just put your head between your legs and kiss your butt goodbye.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've started doing is I've started actually buying the books and the magazines and putting them back in as hard copy because I've got a ton of stuff on my computer, but if I lost my computer and shit hits the fan, I'm screwed.
Right.
So I've been really taking the library.
Good.
Well, and I know a lot of preppers that have like an iPad and they just downloaded like 50,000 books on them. And that's the thing. What happens if you lose the cord? that's crazy.
Do you know who those preppers remind me of? Those preppers remind me of the protesters down in Arizona who showed up fully armed saying they're going against Trumpers. But if you look at the AR-15s and the other firearms, they were paintball guns.
I told
you that
last week.
Did you look at my group?
Yeah,
they weren't even real.
I posted that group. So
yeah,
if you looked at that, you would have seen that.
Yeah.
I posted something
about
that.
Last week, and I don't even know guns, but I saw the little thing on the side that you could put BBs in.
Yeah. It was funny about
and then
that
one lady, one picture I posted, she had a magazine upside down with 5 rounds in it. Sitting up, which, hello, you get dirt in there, you're screwed.
Well, here's the thing, is that picture right now, that is now my mentality. Whenever somebody says something about prepping, and you know they haven't done squat, that picture flashes in my head. Literally. You know, because that's what they're doing.
My wife, she hates guns, but she took that, and I thought she's going to die laughing.
Right.
She said, what the hell is that? Beep, beep, thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I know better than that, and I don't like guns.
Well, I didn't want to derail the conversation, but what I wanted to do was point out that right there, we have a huge amount of people prepping that some people are relying on. They're thinking, if something happens, I'm going to rely on Joe over here. And Joe's flashing his paintball gun instead of an AR-15 because he knows he can't do crap. So, guys, really know your group. Really know your people, know your position, and know who you're dealing with. I've made it very clear. I can't can to save my life. I can people die. So if you have to rely on me for canning, you're screwed. I can hunt all day long, okay? But that's the honesty that needs to be brought out when it comes to these groups and the conversations that we have as preppers. We need to be honest with each other. This is not a pissing contest. This is not a testosterone contest. This is a survival contest. And just because Joe Schmo sitting over here says, I'm going to do this and this and this, Joe Schmo probably can't get out of bed because he hasn't eaten anything besides a McDonald's hamburger in the last 15 years.
Granted, I'm
McDonald's.
Kind of overweight, but, I'll get out there and I know what I got to do and I know how to hunt. I've hunted. I know how to track.
And overweight isn't necessarily a horrible thing unless you're going to be chased and all the hard work you got to do because you're going to be on a limited diet, you're going to be working, you're going to be walking, you're going to be doing things. That's going to naturally come off,
exactly.
unless you're like 400 pounds overweight, which is a health issue.
I'm pretty far from that. I'm about
normal
about
stuff is
going to
come
over.
Off. But Don made a good point about knowing your people. I was talking to some people, and they were saying, we have a group, and we have this, and we have that. And I said, well, let's talk about your group. And it was basically, just everybody's going to come down and do their own thing when shit hits the fan, and we'll all kind of get along together, and we'll figure it out. And I'm thinking,
you know, that's not going to happen. And then who's feeding them, and who's got weapons, and who's paying for the ammo, and who's got clothes, and, you know, you got to know who's in your group and what they know.
Exactly. You know, who's the seamstress? Who can sew? Who can make clothes? Who can mend clothes? Who can fix the weapons? Who can make weapons? Who can go out and actually track and hunt? Who can actually dress to kill?
And going in accordance with the show, who actually knows what's out there that's edible, not just because they heard somebody
exactly,
say
that too.
Because they know the list. Who can actually walk out in those woods and say, yep, dope, yeah, not ready, that one needs to go a little bit, yes, we're good. These are things that I, as a homeschooler, am starting to instill in my kids because I want them to have that. Well, not necessarily, because I'm talking teenagers. So when we go out and they say, yeah, that's this, they're good by rope, that doesn't mean they're learning it. So I'm saturating, hoping something sticks, kind of like feeding with a spaghetti shotgun. I hit the walls, they have their mouths open, hopefully they eat something. But, you know, at the same time...
I like that analogy. I'm gonna repeat that in my group. That's good.
At the same time, I was freaked out how much I thought I knew, and I'm a proud pagan. I'm a proud holistic kitchen witch pagan. I was freaked out by how much when we went the first walk, I could not recognize 14 plants that were there.
Right.
So, you know,
there's nothing wrong with that. I mean.
But
I'll be honest with you. I'm a human.
As long as you recognize that you don't know them.
Right.
She didn't or anything, but...
That's what Julie's trying to say. These are things that we need to be recognizing, and we need to understand that you cannot just look at a book and point and say, that's it. That's why she said she doesn't like certain pictures. You better be able to rely on it. If you've got that woman who says she's an herbalist and she knows what she's doing, you better know that before the shit hits the fan, she hasn't been shopping at
Exactly.
Red Meyer.
Exactly. My wife's sitting here nodding like crazy, going, yep.
Well, and, you know, pictures look different. People they're trying to capture it, but when you go out in the woods and you're looking underside of a leaf and it looks kind of, you got four plants that look exactly the same, except the leaf has got just a little bit different on each one. One is wavy, one has fingers, one is pointy, one is, you know, all of that means something different. And then
exactly.
You've got to be able to do it. And one thing you can do is if you want to know plants, you take samples, put them in baggies, and take them down to your county extension office. And say, or to your college, there's a community college or a botany teacher or something, and look, say, hey, I think this is this. Is this an edible plant? Is this what I think it is? And they'll talk your ear off because botanists love to talk plants. And then they can say, no, that's not, because see how this plant has this? That this is a false whatever. And those are really interesting. And if you do like two or three, it's the same thing we used to do like with mushrooms. My friend, when she started mushroom hunting, she'd take them into the county extension office, she'd take them down to the ranger station, she'd take them to the biology department at the university until she could positively ID stuff. And that's, you know, it's what it is, but there's lots of creative ways to figure stuff out. So.
Oh, no, this brings up something else. We know what you
have
can
your whole college extension, you're not going to have all that.
One of the things that you could also do in your local area is get a hold of your park rangers. Get a hold of your park rangers, say, hey, we want to go ahead and do in small stages so we learn them all. Can we go ahead and spend like a month of every Saturday and show us different things? They love to share their knowledge. A lot of these guys, they're bored because they really don't have much to do with their maintaining of the park. So yeah, they'd be more than interested in doing it.
Absolutely. And Mike, this was meant like now, like this summer. If you want to learn plants, see if you can go find like your dandelions or your whatever you don't really, I mean, everybody knows what a dandelion is, but I'm saying like chicory or something, and then take it down to the mechanic.
Looking yellow thing?
Yeah, and say, this is what I think this is. Is this what I think it is? Then you learn to, you get positive ID on it, and you'll know. I mean, there's horror stories of guides out there who took people out on foraging trips, and they all ate poison hemlock for lunch because they thought it was something else, you know?
Uh-huh.
And there was
And hemlock is the most poisonous thing you can possibly eat.
No, it's not.
Yeah,
it's oleander. No, oleander.
But
hemlock actually has uses.
Poison
this
a lot
whole,
like another
is in the proper proportions. Yes, it
eat
does.
A small drip, 2 drops of oleander in a cup of coffee will kill a man.
Exactly.
I would.
I know that, but hemlock is even worse.
No, I actually am certified to work with hemlock, and I'm going to have to disagree with you on that.
Okay, well, we're just going to have to agree to disagree because everything I've been taught is hemlock.
If you don't know about it, stay away from
worse.
It.
Right. No, if you don't know about it, stay away from it. I'm just saying that I actually use it on a regular basis for several reasons. So it's a digitalis that can be very beneficial if handled correctly, but there is no correct handling of oleander whatsoever.
Well, hemlock, I agree with you on that. You know, there are proper handling procedures. But how many laymen understand that and know how to do it?
Oh, they don't.
Really?
The reason I say
that,
therefore, it is one of the most poisonous.
It is one of the most poisonous. But you want to know why I say oleander's worse? Do you know what oleander is?
Yes, I do. I am fully aware of what it is and what it can do to you.
Right, but
it
most
can kill
people
you in what, under less than an hour, if I'm not mistaken?
Well, yeah, but Mike, what I'm saying, most people are not aware. When they're driving down the freeway and they see that pretty, you know, especially in California, where they see that pretty flowering bush that's put in the middle, the landscapers for the government use this for their freeways. Okay? It's a very cool plant. And they actually just put it all over the place. And it's landscaping. You touch it, the oil gets seeps into your skin in toxic levels, and people don't realize it. So yeah, it's just that's a conversation we're gonna have another time. So I'd like to
exactly
talk about
it. Another topic.
Yeah, you and I can have that conversation another time. I think it'd be really great on medicinal and legal. So anyway, getting back to foraging. Julie, I had a question for you.
Okay.
When it comes to foraging in the winter, especially when you start talking like your elevation versus my elevation, you've heard a lot of these wild men talk about, and when I say wild men, we're talking about those who live out in the wild, and they actually, this is what they do for a living. They talk about eating lichens, they talk about eating mulch, they talk about eating moss. I don't see it. How?
It's really dry and bitter, but it's edible. Up here, it's not as. It depends when it starts growing in the spring. It's actually quite soft. But you know, by the time it's sat on the tree for a while, it gets really dry. But you can make a tea out of it and boil the nutrients out of it. I suppose if you're starving, you're going to shove it in your mouth and chew and swallow. I mean, there's been, you know, people who have been lost in the woods eat grass. So it's what it is. It goes along with if you're hungry, you're hungry. I mean, but there's so many things you can eat. There's acorns. You guys have acorns over there like crazy. You got chickweed, you got dandelions, you got burdock, you got garlic, you got pine needles, you got rose hips, you got plantain, you've got nettles, you've got blackberry leaves, you know, all those things you guys can just eat. And all winter long, you guys have blackberry leaves out there, don't you?
Yes.
They don't.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I don't know about anybody else, but we do here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We got from the lower. You know, another thing that grows here a lot of people don't realize because it's not indigenous is we got bamboo from hell.
Oh, bamboo is delicious. We get it young. But we've got juniper, birch bark, you got nuts and, you know, pine cones in the spring before the squirrels and the chipmunks get to them. That's where your pine nuts come from. Up here we have a bearberry knick-knick. They're real short to the ground. They grow wild everywhere. You got miner's lettuce. But, you know, there's so much to do. I've read before, there is no reason for somebody to starve in Washington State. Lichen is the stuff you're thinking of is the usnea, I think, or the lichen we have up here. It's that real pale stuff, and it's real long, hangs in the trees. That's edible. We have that green stuff that grows on the sides. You can make tea out of it. You can reindeer moss. But you should cook them because they can cause digestive problems if they're raw, a lot of them. Turkey tail, they're real hard. I only see them in hard stages on logs. Those are a form of lichen. They look kind of like a mushroom. You can cook those too. There's John said, or somebody said, don't we have wild strawberries too? That's Dawn. We do, but they're so teeny. You got to gather a lot of them. Up here, there's wild strawberries up here. We've got huckleberries, we got blackberries, we got bearberries, we got salmon berries, we got all sorts of stuff. You could probably fight the birds for the stuff that's stuck on the branches, but most of that stuff is late spring, summer to early fall, and that's our problem with that sort of thing. But there's no reason to starve up here. There's no reason to starve up here. You just got to be aware. People, you know, when we first started the show, I talked once about our history, kind of about what gives us, what makes us qualified to talk about this stuff. And I don't know, Don, did we ever get your history?
What was that?
Did we ever get your history on your prepping history? Why? What makes you qualified to talk about this stuff versus me?
A little bit. I mean, basically with mine, the short is being raised the way I was. First off, we've talked kind of about the Mormon angle, that my mom was Mormon, and we were raised, heat it up, wear it out, make it do or go without, self-preparedness, the prepping that goes into that, the canning, the food food storage, making sure your neighbors are taken care of, your medical, you know, that type of thing. But one of the things we didn't get into is my family's gone through a couple of travesties, if you will. When the Teton Dam broke in Idaho in the 70s, my mom lost. And notice I always talk about my mom. We're not talking about my dad ever. So just don't even bring it up. Yeah, don't even, you know, I mean, don't voice me, don't ask me, none of your business. Anyway, the Teton Dam broke, and my mom was one of those that lost everything when the Teton Dam broke. The first lesson in prepping that I learned that day for real as a kid, even though I've been raised with it, was we drove out of Idaho and to a hotel, and from a hotel to a little trailer that she had been renting, and she opened it up, and there was her food storage. First lesson I learned,
so
we lost everything.
Way ahead of it.
We were ahead of it. She didn't know what was going to happen. She just wanted to make sure her kids were taken care of. Now, the reason her mentality is that way is because she's a child of the Depression era.
We napped together. And
she was there in the Depression. And so she knows truly what it means to stuff your mattress with corn husks, to, you know, take your socks, and when they have holes in them to the point you can no longer wear them, stitch them up so now you have something to use to straighten your cheese with. Okay, this type of thing. Make a long story short, I was raised with that mentality. So where other kids, they didn't like their shoes, they got new shoes. I had to wait until I had holes in the bottom of my shoes, and then we just resold them. Okay. So my background with prepping is I lived it. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm saying it taught me a whole new appreciation for stuff that a lot of people don't have. Who's naked?
Not more.
Right. Right. Well, we've got like 5 minutes left in the show.
Do we?
And that's the
make sure you
eat
free and do a live show.
Huh?
No, we got half an hour left.
Yeah, we went for an hour and a half today instead of two because I wasn't sure how much information I was going to have. And I know when I'm nervous, I talk straight through everything.
Yes, you do.
When I
do. Yes, you do. But that's cool.
I'm so boring. I totally get that. Because nobody was talking to me. So.
I was trying to, but I was muted.
We
didn't
mute
you.
Anybody. Nobody muted you. Your phone muted you. NSA, talk to them.
I do.
NSA, exactly. There you go. NSA.
I will figure it out eventually.
Don't worry about it, boy.
Well,
good.
On a good
interaction
note,
is nice,
great,
guys.
You did great. Now show up at my meet and greet and do a live show.
When is the meet and greet?
June 30th through July 8th.
Where?
I don't know if I'll be there, but maybe.
Illinois.
Illinois? Okay.
Where in Illinois?
I'm headed to Florida in August.
State Park. There. I'm not on my computer. So you're in my group, Julie.
Huh?
Ask Ron Williams. He's the one that's in charge of it.
All right. Well,
he will tell you everything. PM me when you get a minute, and when I get to my computer again, I'll pull all the information up and give it to you.
All right. Well, I thank everybody for coming and talking on the show.
I know we only have 10 minutes, but you're going to back up here, Julie. What do you mean you're going to Florida in August? Are you coming back?
Oh, anyway, we have 3 minutes.
You said
Sting.
It. Come on.
Sting.
You said it.
Sting,
no,
we
no,
have
no.
3 minutes.
You said it. You brought it up. Now bring it up. Are you coming back or are you staying?
Well, this has been ladies.
You're going from cold to hot. And humid, Julie, so be ready for that.
I've been down there. Yeah. We'll talk about it. Go to Facebook when you're done, Don, and we'll talk about it. But according to the thing, we have like 3 minutes left. I know I'm boring. Thank you for sticking it out.
No,
it
you're not
got
boring.
More interesting when everybody else started talking. Don't forget that John's got T-shirts, and everybody needs to go buy a T-shirt. Apparently there's a prepper meet and greet in Illinois in June or July. June and July. So that's it for Ladies of the Watch tonight. Stay tuned tomorrow night. John is going to be discussing what John discusses. And we'll talk about something new next week.
More information to post in the chat next week.
All
yeah,
right.
Quick, plug,
thanks
plug
very
plug
much.
Real,
you guys have a good night.
Julie,
you too, girl.
Plug.
All right. Good night, all.
Good night.
Welcome to Total Wine and More. It's much more than a wine store. It's the eighth wonder of the world.
When people talk about Total Wine and More, they get a little carried away. We're just a big, friendly place run by people with a passion for wine and beer. See, we travel the world to find the best wines from the best regions, and we sell them at the lowest prices anywhere.
And friendly, helpful experts at every turn.
You know what? Maybe we are the eighth wonder of the world.
Shop in store or online at TotalWine.com.
Welcome to Total Wine and More. It's much more than a wine store. It's the eighth wonder of the world.
When people talk about Total Wine and More, they get a little carried away. We're just a big, friendly place run by people with a passion for wine and beer. See, we travel the world to find the best wines from the best regions, and we sell them at the lowest prices anywhere.
And friendly, helpful experts at every turn.
You know what? Maybe we are the eighth wonder of the world.
Shop in store or online at TotalWine.com.